This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. My guest today is best known by his professional wrestling name, Kane. But Glenn Jacobs isn't just a member of the WWE Hall of Fame. Since 2018, he served as the mayor of Knox County, Tennessee, where he has beat down tax increases and mask and vaccine mandates while pushing school choice and private sector solutions to social problems. We talk about how Ron Paul inspired him, why he believes Donald Trump is disrupting the administrative state, and why live and let live is the best life philosophy. Here is the Reason interview with Glenn Jacobs. Glenn Jacobs, also known as Hall of Fame wrestler Kane, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we happen to be meeting in this small room in Texas because we're both at Ron Paul's 90th birthday party / barbecue. You've talked highly of Ron Paul in the past. Why don't you start by saying, like, what did Ron Paul do for you kind of politically or ideologically?
So I was already aware of the Liberty Movement and was kind of going down the rabbit hole when I came across Ron Paul. It was actually John Stossel's documentary called Mr. Stossel Goes to Washington, and he interviews Ron Paul. And I was like, who's this crazy congressman from Texas who I agree with on pretty much everything. Obviously, it was Dr. Paul. And for me, you know, we'll hear things like, well, Ron Paul cured my apathy. I wasn't apathetic. I was very, very concerned and cared very much about things going on. But I think, like many people, I felt somewhat hopeless in that just the political situation, there was no point in being involved because everything was just going down the drain. And then Ron Paul comes along and activates this huge movement and just really changed so much and things that still reverberate today.
What do you think it was that you know, what was the message? And I mean, this is in the aughts, and it's hard to remember last week, much less 15 or 20 years ago. But we're coming out of the Bush administration and, you know, a lot of domestic spending, but especially a lot of kind of foreign policy that was both done kind of on the sly, but also poorly. I mean, it was just failing. And then Obama kind of is there as, oh, I'm an anti-war candidate, but not so much. Like, what is it about Ron Paul, do you think, that like really sparked that?
It was tying the fiscal conservatism together with a non-interventionist foreign policy. You know, a lot of Republicans, including myself, were wondering why are we running around the world being the world's policeman? It's very expensive, and obviously we lose American boys and girls in these foreign conflicts that we don't belong in. So to hear a Republican candidate say that, to articulate all those things, I think that's what the masses, you know, that's where the mass appeal came from. Then for someone like me who's very interested in economics, obviously with, you know, talk about the Federal Reserve and how the Federal Reserve and central banking is what fuels all of these wrongheaded policies. And to have someone actually say that and to talk about those things and again, articulate those in a way that people could easily understand. And he was just so much different. He was the actual anti-establishment candidate. And with the Bush administration, obviously, you know, the GOP had taken a hard turn towards no longer the party of Reagan, but now the big spending conservatives, right? What big government conservatives. Ron was the opposite of that.
What was it about Reagan that, I mean, he's kind of your first political idol, right? And what did you like about Reagan?
With Reagan, it was the fiscal conservatism, common sense. You know, even Reagan, when you look at his foreign policy, you know, he was maybe not the non-interventionist that Ron Paul was, but Reagan understood things like in the Middle East, you know, with the the bombing at the Beirut Marine barracks, you know, we don't understand the Middle East. Do we really need to be that involved there? So at its core, Reagan was very common sense. And Reagan was also, he was a big believer in free enterprise and the free market. And to me, that should be the core of, on a political side, of the Republican message.
Reagan was kind of bellicose when he talked. I mean, he called the Soviet Union an evil empire. He was going to push back against stuff. But in terms of interventions, he didn't dispatch that many troops.
He didn't. And he also talked. he set a precedent, but then he was willing to talk. And, you know, it's not this, oh, we're not going to talk to you, and then we're just going to bomb you and start a war. You know, Reagan actually was willing to talk and to negotiate. And that's a lot of the reason that the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union went away.
Do you think, though, you know, you mentioned him as a fiscal conservative, and this is part of the Republican Party's, you know, credibility issue, right? They always are talking about we got to cut government. Reagan famously said, you know, you know, the message from the government, I'm here to help you, is the worst thing you can hear. But he grew the size and scope and spending of government.
In some ways, yes. I don't disagree with that. I think, you know, for me, it's the rhetoric of saying, you know, this this is what we should aspire to.
Right.
You know, and that actual belief that that's how things should be.
Yeah, and that things could get better too, I guess, right?
Because one of the most important things about Reagan for me, and I'm a child of the, I grew up in the 70s, was that optimism, you know, bringing back that can-do spirit of America. And it was not the government is here to save you. It's the American people. The American people, given the opportunity, can make our country a great place.
Boy, that seems to be missing from either party now, right? It's because even Trump, it's like he has to save us more than you or me saving ourselves.
I think that even with Trump, it is empowering the individual. You know, not some folks will look at it and say it's all about Trump, but for me, what it says is, you know, we have a role to play in that.
You endorsed Trump, right? Both in 2024. Did you also in 2020 and 2016?
Yes.
Yeah. So you're straight ticket. What you know, how does Trump stack up compared to somebody like a Reagan and a Ron Paul, you know, and then you got Donald Trump?
Yeah, obviously Trump is different and he's his own person. I think one thing that we should remember about Donald Trump is a lot of folks think that he does it just for his ego. Well, he did get shot.
I'm sorry, what?
He did get shot and stayed in the race. I think that he believes in what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
And especially in especially in the early days of this administration, it was it was actually breathtaking to watch some of the things that he was doing, like pardoning Ross Ulbricht. And, you know, my hope is that, you know, obviously, as you move further and further through administration, especially now in the second administration, where you'll begin to lose influence towards the end. But my hope, especially with this administration, and you saw it there at the start, and I think you're still seeing it, is pushing back against the administrative state and the deep state.
Right.
That's one of the major issues that our country
and
faces.
And not just in foreign policy or intelligence, everything. The kind of the blob that just
everything,
keeps
going. Yes. You know, people, I don't think the average person understands that it's not Congress or the president that are actually running things. Now, they might set policy, but in the end, it's the administrative state and the bureaucrats who are actually populating the rules. They're the ones that are actually running most of the government.
Do you worry with somebody like Trump, you know, and he, well, he didn't say this, but Steve Bannon, his advisor in the first term, said he was going to deconstruct the administrative state, that, you know, which was pretty exciting to hear. Do you feel like, you know, Trump is spending tons of money and he wants to spend money? He doesn't care about debt or deficit. He, you know, he's like for more of it always. Do you feel like he is going to dismantle the way that bureaucrats or government agencies can go after people for whatever reason they want? Or is he kind of part of the problem?
No, I think he is trying to dismantle that. You know, you see with say the IRS and some of the other agencies that they have made moves to limit their authority. And I think a lot of what Trump does as well, when you hear his rhetoric, it's almost like what Reagan did as far as being very tough over here, but that sets up easier to push some policies through perhaps.
Do you worry about, you know, the talk about ICE in particular and other, you know, agencies kind of, you know, going around masked? You know, Trump hates masks except for ICE agents.
Right.
And, you know, picking up people merely because they're speaking Spanish. Does this worry you?
It doesn't. I mean, that's why we have a court system and a legal system. People have been afforded due process, you know, and so that's not something that actually does worry me.
You feel like the system's holding on that?
I think the system is holding up, yes. Okay. From what I've seen, yes.
Yeah. Let's talk. You are about your domain. You are the mayor of Knox County in Tennessee. What does it mean to be a mayor of a county? How is that different than being a mayor of a city?
It's the equivalent.
Yeah.
I basically am in charge of the government day-to-day operations outside of the city of Knoxville, so the unincorporated parts of Knox County, which is larger than the city.
Yeah.
The Knox County is about 500,000 people. 190,000 of those live in the city of Knoxville. About 25,000 live in a town called Farragut. So most of the people actually live in the county, and we are the county government. In Tennessee, in Tennessee, they went to the term mayor for counties. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because we do have a legislative and an executive branch.
Okay.
You'll see the same thing across the country as far as your county government.
Right.
You know, but they might, my position might be the equivalent of a judge executive, or even a commissioner.
Right. You came into office saying, you know, you're not going to raise taxes, you're going to cut spending. Have you been keeping your word?
I have, as much as possible. Now, one thing that we do need to keep in mind is this. We're very subject to inflation, just like private sectors, just like families are. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've seen growth in our budget in nominal terms, but in real dollars, it's about what it was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Same with our debt. Our per person spend adjusted for inflation is the equivalent of maybe just a tad more than it was about 10 years ago. But that's also due to some money from the federal government and the state coming through. Our schools are in our budget as well, but they're really a separate entity.
Yeah.
We've seen a slight decrease in our bonded indebtedness per person, and we have not raised property taxes. And just alone is in this day and age, keeping up with inflation, that alone is a challenge.
And also in Tennessee, you don't have a state income tax. So it's really property tax and sales tax or funding.
Yes.
How do you maintain good services or even increase services while not raising revenue?
That is, it's really the key to my philosophy. A lot of it is working with the private sector, working with nonprofits, working with the faith-based community on some of the social services that other places might rely on government exclusively to do.
Yeah.
You know, we might have a role in it, but we work very closely with nonprofits on some of those things.
Can you give me an example of what's a good or a service that they're providing?
Sure. One is when I first came into office, realized that the drug epidemic was a big issue. Worked with the faith-based community, and they started an outpatient faith-based recovery center. They did that within a year and had it up and running. If it had been the government, we'd still be talking about it and doing studies.
Wait,
and
when you say drug epidemic, do you mean opioids?
Opioids, meth, all those sort of things. The addiction epidemic, yes.
And how do they, do they provide counseling services and things like that?
Yeah.
Do they get money from the state or?
No.
So it's really letting them.
We've helped with some capital grants when we've had money left over passed through.
Yeah.
But as far as the operational budget, it's all theirs. And I think it's been a very small amount of their budget that we've provided. Do the same with many of the other social services that you would think of. That government and in some places government, that's what they do.
Right.
What we do is we work with nonprofits. Mm-hmm. They provide the service. Sometimes we do give them some funding, but still, from my perspective, it's better if they're doing it than if we have a county department that's in charge of that.
Do you do they also do like food relief and things, or what are the other kinds of services that are that you can do this?
Right. With? You know, mental health services, housing, domestic violence, all those sort of things. Yes, food services, just everything that you would think of that a place like New York City would take it upon themselves to do. We work with United Way, Boys and Girls Club, all of those folks, and they actually end up providing services.
You know, Tennessee is it's a state that is growing and is kind of having a boom, or at least large parts of it are. Memphis is not doing so well. Nashville is booming. Knoxville, a university town, the natural beauty of Tennessee is becoming more appreciated by more people. What is the secret to that kind of local and state governance? And, because it shouldn't, if it if you guys can do it, it should be easy to do everywhere. Like, how do you keep services, you know, either high or competent enough, but taxes low without constantly creeping upward?
It is that conservative / libertarian philosophy mm-hmm. that government is not there to solve every problem. Our mm-hmm. governor says that all the time, Governor Bill Lee, mm-hmm. You know, that basically it's the Reagan S quote that government's the problem, not the solution. It's the people that are the solution. So it's confining government to its box and making sure that it doesn't get out of that box, mm-hmm. which is always a challenge
yeah.
because you always have people that want it to grow. Sometimes, and obviously sometimes, you know, they're good people think, oh, we should be doing this. Mm-hmm. Well, you also have to understand that everything government does relies on tax dollars. So we're hurting some people by taking money away from them mm-hmm. so that we can spread it out among other people. And to me, that just doesn't seem right. You know, it's more of motivating people to get involved and help each other as opposed to government forcibly taking the money from
and
them.
And is that, I mean, like, you know, Tennessee has a lot of new people in it. Like, is it, you know, do people move there because they're into that? Do you indoctrinate them? How do you keep, you know, I lived in Ohio for a long time yeah. and Ohio, one level will be like, you know, we're salt of the earth and everything, but everybody there was looking for a handout. So it's not like you get off the coast and people suddenly become,
right.
You know, self-sufficient, you know, libertarians or anything. I mean, where is that? Like, how do you keep that spirit alive?
For us, it's allowing people to keep as much money there of mm-hmm. their own as possible. Yeah. We don't have a state income tax in Tennessee. We actually have the lowest state and local tax burden in the country. The people that I talk to that have moved from places like California, have moved because of mm-hmm. the basically, and then some of the social policies in California as mm-hmm. well. You know, Tennessee is much more conservative on the social mm-hmm. side of things. And we've just been able to differentiate ourselves mm-hmm. in that way. So people are voting with their feet. I think this yeah. is something we see around the country. And that's why, you know, more conservative / libertarian folks are moving to places right. like Texas, Florida, and Tennessee.
Yeah.
And I would argue that a lot of it, though, is economic policy.
Yeah.
And as far as on, you know, on the company corporate side, jobs are coming because right. of a favorable tax environment. We're a right to work state. That's mm-hmm. It's enshrined in our constitution. Our regulatory shell is, you know, a lot more reasonable than a lot of places around the country. So all of those things combine to make us a pleasant place to live.
And I guess the world is smaller now, so it might have been, you know, 50 years ago, Tennessee,
sure.
particularly outside of Nashville or Memphis, seems like, oh, that's a million miles on the edge of the universe, and it's really kind of the center now.
Yeah, and
everywhere.
You're exactly center, right. Yeah. Even before the COVID-19 pandemic, there was a trend to people moving to mid-sized cities and right. not big cities. Now with the ability to work remotely in right. many industries, we see that as well. People that want to move for a better quality of life yeah. And the lower taxes and all those sort of things, but then they can still keep their job someplace else.
Before we continue with the Reason interview, I want to ask you to help make this podcast and all Reason podcasts better. Please fill out our audience survey. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, and I'll give you a chance to win a $300 gift card. The link to the survey is in the show notes for this episode. It'll really help us out. And now, back to the Reason interview.
Speaking of COVID, you were outspoken against mask mandates and basically all sorts of mandates. Where did your opposition to that kind of stuff come from? Because there were a lot of subsidies riding on, you know, and this is something Trump is the one who locked the country down, you know, and then Biden kind of, you know, poured gasoline, steroids, whatever yeah. your intensifier of choice is. Why did you say no to mask mandates?
Because it was unconstitutional and mm-hmm. and it was causing harm. In our public school system, there had been a mask mandate mm-hmm. and we also have to understand that everyone's panicking at the start, yeah. you know, and there had been a frenzy of just mm-hmm. fear had been whipped up. But even as early as March of, first of all, I was like, this is, there's something going on here. As early as March of 2020, I was like, I'm questioning this. By April of 2020, I was like, we're going down the wrong yeah. path, right? And that was really because, you know, I just never bought into the fear. And I would look at things like, you know, flatten the curve. Okay, I got that, you know, because that was really to give the hospitals more time to prepare. But then I thought to myself, well, all of these graphs with the curve ended a certain date. What happens after that date? And then you would look at them and it really didn't matter. You're going to end up in the same place. And just a lot of the things that were happening weren't making any sense to me. But for our schools, you know, like pretty much everyone else around the country, they put in a mask mandate. Then they lifted it. Then twice they voted not to reimpose it. Then a federal judge reimposed the mask mandate. And he said that this is not harming children to do this. And some children, you know, that have immunocompromised systems would be harmed. Well, the problem with that was my office is receiving calls from the parents, for instance, of a young lady who had developed a little girl who developed an anxiety disorder because of the mask and was pulling her hair out. Another kid, a little boy who suffered from severe eczema, who couldn't wear a mask because it made his face break out. He's all happy because he gets to go back to school. He can't go back to school now because the judge reimposed the mask mandate. And, you know, then for someone to say that that was causing no harm. Well, yeah, it's not causing any harm if you're not the people fielding the calls from the folks reporting the harm.
So part of it was the idea of a one size fits all kind of rule issued from on high or even nearby. It's just
And, you know, to me, that was that particular instance also, you know, flew in the face of federalism, you know, states' rights, all of those things, you know, and also that particular case, the judge opined that he could use the ADA, even though it had never been used in this way, to regulate behavior, which the ADA had, he said, had never been used before. I was like, well, okay, that's it. I mean, now you can just, under anything, you can justify ADA.
And that's the Americans with
Disabilities. The Americans with Disabilities Act. And that was the other thing. I just, I looked at the precedent that all of this was setting. And in the end, it was, you know, COVID-19 obviously was a serious public health issue, but from the government response, the bigger issue was the devastation it was going to cause both to our freedom and to our economy. When you're shutting businesses down, and still now our supply chains are suffering because they were broken during COVID. And it doesn't take a genius to figure out, you know, that once, you know, global supply chains are broken, it's going to take a long time for them to come back online.
Yeah, I mean, you can throw the kill switch on the economy a lot more than you can
pull it back on. And you know, we have people talking about the economy. It was the old idea of the economy is a machine and we can regulate it. And I even heard things like, you know, we'll just, it's a dimmer and we can dimmer it down. I'm like, no, it's not. It's the economy is an ecosystem and you're throwing a bunch of bleach in it and you're going to kill everything.
Right. How do you feel about vaccines and, you know, and particularly COVID vaccines? You know, because interestingly, you know, polls showed in the early 2010s, people on the left tended to be more anti-vaccine. Now it's definitely people on the right tend to be more anti-vaccine. And COVID, you know, it gets complicated really quickly because the mRNA vaccines clearly didn't stop transmission, as people were saying, but it did. They did reduce severity. So, you know, and then, you know, that, okay, so there's that information. Then, you know, is a mandate the way to go or is it something people should do voluntarily? Should businesses have the right not to let people in who aren't vaccinated, you know, how did that play out for you and your decision?
When the COVID-19 vaccine first came out, I was actually, this is okay. People that older folks and people that choose to take this because they have systems are compromised. Okay. We can get back to normal because all of these things supposedly, you know, were to protect those folks. Well, obviously as what generally happens, it goes from the 90-year-olds and 80-year-olds getting the vaccine to everybody getting it, including kids. And this posed virtually no threat whatsoever.
And offered real
Then I'm like, okay, no. And it should have never been, it should have never been mandated. In fact, when President Biden issued his, tried to issue his mandate, not that he ever read it, but I did write a letter to him stating that we would not comply with that in Knox County.
How does that feel? Like, obviously, you, as a professional wrestler, you, you know, first off, you're both like a huge guy and you can take care of yourself, but you also know how to posture and kind of, you know, both fight rhetorically as well as physically. When you tell the president of the United States, like, fuck, you know, screw me, buddy. Like, you know, how, I mean, do you ever like, maybe I'm making a mistake here?
No. No, yeah. It's a principle. And because I did that, though, what happened then is our sheriff then said, and he would have done it anyway, but this actually happened throughout COVID.
Yeah.
I was able to provide other elected officials with political cover because they would just say, well, this is what Mayor Jacobs is saying. One of the coolest things I learned actually pretty much after the pandemic had ended, I was I was at an event in another county speaking with a district attorney general who in another jurisdiction who told me that he looked at what I was saying during COVID. And because of that, he decided that he wouldn't prosecute folks that violated public health orders.
Oh, wow.
You know, so you think about it, you're actually able to keep people out of jail or keep them from being fined. That's a good feeling.
Yeah.
And then it's worth it no matter what.
In your kind of political philosophy, because you're, you know, you're conservative / libertarian, leave people alone, you know, provide basic services, but then let people kind of figure out how they want to live their lives. What's the role of social issues in that? Because you mentioned, you know, places like maybe California and New York tend to be more liberal. Is, you know, what are you talking about there? And like, you know, how does that play into your philosophy?
Yeah, for me, you know, specifically things like LGBT Q issues, that sort of thing. Look, I don't care how you want to live your life. Just don't push it on everybody else.
Right.
You know, and that's basically been my philosophy.
And so does that mean in terms of, you know, I mean, obviously the thing that's been hot for a while is the idea that trans, you know, students who are transgender can play in the sport, you know, on the sports team or use the locker room or the bathroom of the sex that they transition to.
Right.
Is that something that schools should decide? Is it something individuals? Is it something the state? Or should it be banned? Or
I would be on the side of, because of issues like public, you know, issues like safety, frankly, and competition, you know, and if we're going to regulate things like sports anyway, yes, you know, and that's one of those things where to me, unfortunately, what has happened with the whole LGBT movement now, it's become a front for cultural Marxism. Frankly, what I mean by that is, you know, it's become a front for changing society, you know, not through economic means and collectivism, but through social means and redefining things like what, you know, what a man and a woman are.
Right.
Okay. That's when I say, you know, look, if you want to do stuff, it's up to you, but don't push those things on me.
Right. So what about something like our, trans teachers, in public schools.
That's going to be for, you know, the school system to decide. It's also since the legislature does in Tennessee, the legislature is the one that ultimately decides those things. They're going to decide.
But should they be like, hey, you know what? That's fine, right? As long as you're not hurting anybody.
The issue isn't what an individual believes as a teacher. The issue is, are they complying with school policy or are they going out of their way to push a particular lifestyle on their kids?
Right.
I think that's the real issue that we're talking about with something like that.
Would that, and that would also, would, you know, if somebody was a very strong Christian and they were talking it up in a public classroom, that would be problematic.
Yeah, obviously, it's the same. It's, you know, you're there to do the job. The problem is, and we've seen this in Knox County occasionally, you know, where a teacher will go off the rails because they, you know, they get away from the approved curriculum and insert their own ideas into it. I think that's where the issue comes in. In Tennessee, you know, we have a constitutional obligation
to provide
public education.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. So that does fall under the purview of the state government.
But that's probably a mistake, don't you think?
What's that?
Providing an education, or maybe not providing for an education, but providing the schools, right?
But we have, you know, we just got universal school choice through and those things, you know, so
that should alleviate a lot of these problems.
I think that's going to move things in the right direction.
Yeah.
Yes. And in fact, I would argue, you know, that it means more than just having a state, you know, state funding for schools. It means the opportunities for people to become educated, if that makes sense.
In ways that they feel, you know, reflect their values and whatnot.
Right.
One of the things that you started, interestingly, in Knox County is a program to do more kind of vote tech training for kids in high school and whatnot. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because this seems to be something, you know, you and I are roughly the same age. I'm a couple of years older than you, but we can remember the era of shop class, or where, you know, some kids would go college prep, some kids would go general, some kids would go VOTEC, and that meant they were getting their foot in the door in various kinds of trades and craft, you know, kind of craftsman type stuff. That kind of went missing. What are you hoping to redress with this program that you've developed?
It is to provide young people with the opportunity to experience different careers. Our entire school system in Knox County is actually doing that now, and I'm very happy about that. You know, for years, the emphasis was everyone graduates from high school and then goes to college and takes on a lot of debt and kind of figures out where to go from there. Instead of saying, look, it's okay if you don't want to go to college, or if you have a different gift, that's okay. You know, and if you want to go straight into the workforce or to a VOTEC school or to a community college, you know, those, we should encourage all those pathways. I think that we've far too long in our education system, because it has been one size fits all. It's been pigeonholing kids instead of, you know, okay, there are different areas, or all of us, I believe, have a different gift. And all of us are going to follow a different pathway through life. So I think that an actual, a robust education system provides opportunities for young people to explore their different gifts and then to pursue that, as opposed to saying, this is the only way that you can be successful.
You grew up outside of St. Louis. What was your educational path?
Mine was high school, then college. My sister,
What did you major in?
Sorry, it's English in college, yeah.
So wait, at what college did you go to?
I went to Truman State University.
Okay, Truman State. Truman State is where Churchill gave his
At Fulton, Missouri.
Speech, right?
Yeah. Well, that was actually Fulton, Missouri was where that happened.
Yeah, okay.
So, yes.
So how did you transition from being an English major in college to becoming a professional wrestler?
I was playing football and hurt myself pretty badly, actually suffered an injury. Wanted to play professional football and that opportunity is no longer there. And I just kind of fell into wrestling. I still wanted to play sports, and I discovered this and it appealed to me. And
so this is also something like Ernie Ladd back in the day. The Rock, obviously.
But you were asking me what my education path was. Mine was pretty traditional. My sister's was as well. My sister was valedictorian of her class. She worked at NASA. We're Lake Jackson, you know, so she worked at NASA in Clearwater, Clear Lake, Johnson Space Center. But my brother went the VOTEC route. And he's an auto mechanic, and he's done very well for himself. So that's also colored how I view education and those opportunities for different kids.
That's great too. I mean, I think that's an overcorrection that we're starting to, you know, saying everybody should go to college to, we're getting back to it. It's like, there's a lot of different stuff out there. You know, one of the things I've read that you've said is that, you know, part of the Ron Paul legacy is that there's more of a libertarian wing, you know, in the Republican Party. I want to believe that. I'm not a Republican, but I am a libertarian. And, you know, I know, you know, from my side of things, it looked like, you know, through the, you know, especially after Bush and then with Obama, it, you know, we in the 2010, we had the Tea Party, which was a response as much to Bush as Obama. Rand Paul, you know, Ron Paul, people like you started emerging, you know, Thomas Massey, Justin Amash. When I look at the Republican Party, especially at the national level, like over the past decade, I, you know, to be honest, and this, it hurts me to say it out loud, but like I see less libertarian ideas ascendant. You know, I hear people talking about saying we got to cut free trade, we got to close the borders, we got to start prosecuting, you know, we got to start throwing more people in jail, you know, even for non-violent crimes. Where do you see the libertarian impulse in the Republican Party?
Yeah, there was no Rand Paul.
Yeah.
No, there was right. no, you know, the folks you just mentioned came yeah. out of the Ron Paul revolution. Right. You know, and then you think about the House Freedom Caucus.
Yeah.
You know, all these ideas, you know, that aren't, not everyone's going to follow, not everyone's going to embrace them 100%. But I think that when you look at the much stronger non-interventionist
yeah.
foreign policy, especially, you know, those things are there and yeah. they were not there before Ron Paul came along.
Okay. Quick lightning round. And let's see if this works. I'm going to name some politicians and I want you to tell me who is their best wrestler analogy.
Okay.
Okay. So Rand Paul.
Macho Man Randy Savage gets the first person to hopped in mind. I don't know if Randy's out there stepping Randy, to a Slim Jim.
Kamala Harris.
Oh, Kamala Harris. It's got to be Vicky Guerrero. And Vicky's a dear friend of mine, but she was incredibly annoying with when she would always say, excuse me.
Joe Biden.
Joe Biden would be basically the... the retired guy who can't remember any of his matches.
Yeah. AOC.
AOC is Daniel Bryan.
Okay. Explain a little bit about that.
Daniel Bryan's, he's a dear friend of mine, but he would just always go out and get the crowd, you know, motivated by saying yes. And he was basically leading the cultural revolution within WWE, within the fan base.
What about Zoran Mondami, the... you know, the Democratic nominee for the mayor of New York.
Oh, gosh. Hopefully he's an up-and-comer who never makes to the big leagues. Okay.
But he's not or the Iron Sheik or Ivan, Ivan the Bear.
No. Hopefully he's just the guy that never quite gets there.
Okay. And then a final question for you. You were term limited out of office, not this fall, but next fall, just as the midterms are coming. What is next for Glenn Jacobs?
Yeah, I don't know at this point. You know, there's might be opportunities in the political realm for me. At the same time, that's not anything I'm married to. I got into this to try to make a difference. I hope that I've done that as Knox County Mayor. I'll be happy with that. I'm not one of those people that thinks, oh my gosh, what's next and where am I going to? I was very fortunate with my wrestling career that's afforded a lot of opportunities for me in the private sector. So it really just depends on what pops up.
All right. We're going to leave it there. Glenn Jacobs, thanks so much.
Thanks, Nick.